This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
I like to do this each time when I get to this point in the course, just to give us a chance to kind of reflect on what we've talked about, what we've seen. And I'd like for us to have a little group discussion now about what are your impressions now of the Protestant Reformation. I'm going to assume some of you have maybe read and studied some of this before. So a lot of what we've talked about is kind of review, and maybe you've gotten a little more detail, but you kind of have a sense. Some of you, this just may be brand new, and I don't know if it's been a struggle for you or not. I remember last year, one of the students told me, and I appreciated him being very candid. He said, "I sure am thankful nobody ever told me any of this before I became a Christian." And I thought that was a pretty astute comment, actually. So what's your impression? There's no right or wrong answer. But I'd like for us just to talk and share ideas about that before we move on. Because we have covered a bunch of stuff. We've seen a lot of the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, what do you think? Well, how have you processed it?
It blossomed into the huge Reformation movement that it ultimately became in its many different forms.
Yes, Norm?
And obviously, as a Reformed person myself, I'm pro the whole Reformation, but there's definitely a lot of sort of unpleasant, messed up things that happened that just kind of shows even, you know, the best of intentions and whatnot. I mean, you know, we still live in a fallen world and we're still human, so.
I took that Westminster Confession class with Dr. Kira, and so what's really neat is that this fills in all the stuff that went on beyond those different creeds and confession. You know, this it puts the drama into it. I'm surprised so many people were martyred. I guess I really didn't realize how, you know, many people were killed over this. But also one of the things that we observed in reading all those different confessions that came out of this, like the Augsburg and these different things, how similar they all were, how they, you know, when the Reformers got down to it and read the scriptures, they all really came up with very similar creeds. Some of them tried to be a little nicer to Catholicism and, you know, their wording was a little more Catholic, but really they all came to very much the same doctrinal unity.
Mm-hmm. That's a helpful reminder, Dale, because when you look at the different branches, one thing that stands out in the history is how divisive in the differences, but the common roots in basic common theology that they did share is important. It's easy to overshadow that with all the intramural warfare they had against one another. I can't remember what I've said there sometime, but I share with y'all the comment by
Caspar Zwingfeld about the Reformation. Kind of captures it from an Anabaptist point of view. He said the Catholics damn the Lutherans damn the Zwinglians damn the Anabaptists damn everybody else. And in those early generations, that's just kind of the way it was perceived. It was kind of everybody against everybody. And that's why I think Gail's comment is helpful, a reminder that despite those things, long term, we do see that they did have more in common than they did difference. All right, other impressions? Feel free.
Honest. Just say what you think. I just think this whole thing stinks. That's fine.
It's given me a better appreciation of the creeds that we do in our church, that we say as a church and worship, and the elements of worship. I remember several years ago when our church in Virginia got a new pastor, he introduced those creeds for the first time, and there was a small rebellion because people thought, oh, this makes it sound stilted and there's no life in it. But that's actually what gave the church life back then, was that their stand on what they believed, and they said it corporately as a body.
That's a good point. Yeah, you just have a proliferation of all these Protestant creeds that kind of come out of the era. Yes.
I think one of the biggest eye-openers to me has been the role of the state in the Reformation. I always thought of it as Protestants versus Catholics, and really didn't think the state was a factor, and it was a huge factor. And I guess the separation of church and state is so ingrained in our culture that it's hard to see how important the state was in these divisions. Among Protestants, I'm just looking up there, a lot of their divisions were how they viewed the state, between Knox and Calvin, even the differences there, and Luther and the Anabaptists, and it seems that the state played a huge role that I've underestimated until now.
That's a good observation. Yes?
It's kind of a different perspective maybe, of course, generally I'm disappointed the way people handle things, and conflicts in particular. It seems that, and also, of course, as it gets over to the Counter-Reformation, the tensions in the 30 Years' War and all, but just the inability to handle conflict well, and makes me go back to what's the underlying reason for that. Foundational thing that I think about is just human pride. But even amongst Protestantism, I wonder how much, God still worked and accomplished his purposes, but if people could have cooperated more, resolved conflict, maybe even agreed to disagree at different times, if it would have shaped things a bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
I have to believe it shaped it the way God wanted it, but I just wonder.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. Well, I think if you think about even our own experience in local churches, how often when there are tensions in churches and it gets exacerbated over time, the temptation to demonize the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets nasty. Those people aren't really teaching the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen, and when it gets to that point, it's really ugly. But how quickly we go to that?
How different it would be if there could be real humility?
Mm-hmm. Other impressions of the Reformation?
As I've been going through all this stuff, it's very eye-opening for me. I've never really looked at this part of history before. I've really enjoyed that. But also coming from a Catholic upbringing, and then also for me, I've been in every different kind of church since then. And it's neat seeing just the beginnings of where these different churches came from. That's been very eye-opening, having such a diverse background, I guess, makes it more interesting.
So now it's not that this one's crazy and this one's not, they're all crazy.
Yeah, that seems to be.
Yes, sir.
I think also it sort of puts a lot of the problems of the modern church today into context. The whole idea of, if I don't like what's going on in this church, I'll go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And if there's something that turns me off, even if it's biblical, but I don't like the way they worship, or I don't like the way the pastor looks, I'm going to go to another church, I'm going to do my own thing. We tend to think that as a modern problem and something that needs to be fixed today rather than something that's been going on for so long and just sort of spun out of control.
That's a good point. Yeah, for each one of those, we could put, 25 or 30 fingers out of each one of those lines, couldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how it's continued. Yes.
as an Episcopalian, I find myself drawing an analogy between what took place in the Reformation and then the struggles of the Episcopal Church today in the United States, being faced realistically with its own mini-Reformation, if you will, or splintering. And I keep bouncing back and forth between those.
Do you find it as an encouragement to pursue your convictions, or do you find this more of a caution?
Well, the comments made over here by the gentleman that if we perhaps had more humility and grace and other positive things, perhaps we wouldn't be faced with what we're being faced with. So that's the reality that I see.
Anybody else? Yes.
I'll say it's made me really think through what issues are worth fighting for, doctrinally speaking, and what ones aren't. And looking throughout history to see where some people fought for specific doctrinal issues, what the ramifications were, versus where they perhaps compromised, and what happened then, and what issues, you know, when the thread is tugged a little bit, the tapestry starts to unravel, and that kind of thing. Just think through that.
That's a good insight, Elizabeth. That's an excellent point. Kind of the whole issue of defining what are the essentials of the faith. Mm-hmm. What really is essential. And as Gail was saying, one of the things that you would find is that those essential things that we identify as Protestants. And isn't it interesting how in each one of the families, those essential things, you can almost, each one of them, guess who you can go back to? If you think about the common ideas that held the Protestants together, who's the one person you can trace them back to in the 16th century? It's Luther. It's Luther. It really is, you know, still the headwaters of the whole thing. And in terms of his doctrine of justification, his understanding of the church, his breaking away from the old, you know, Catholic doctrines, and certainly sola scriptura, which is understood in different ways, but in terms of affirming that basic doctrine, they all did. And even the Anabaptists, who got run out of town, would have to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of the essential beliefs you can trace back to Luther too.
I think for me personally, where I am in life and my journey, that it's really made me reevaluate, you know, my convictions. I have strong convictions, but maybe I based them too much on others' insight, and it's made me really get in the Word and dig and pursue, you know, why I have stood so strongly. For me, it's just been real personal, because it's just hard to even understand where you're coming from. But yet, at the same time, it's made me realize that so many times I just went on the, kind of like the Catholic Church, you know, whatever I was taught, that was it. And I thought, I've been walking that path. And so it's made me really examine what I was taught, or as a child, I don't know,
it's good. Well, Luther would be pleased. Scripture alone. Anybody else? Yeah, you said, or you can go a second time.
You know, one thing that I learned coming from a history background, and at AF, they kind of took a class in this period. They kind of just painted Luther and all these guys as just normal, kind of almost fanatics, like, weren't educated almost, and, you know, weren't very intellectually smart. They were just zealous about God. And I think that it's very interesting to see that the foundations of our faith come from people who are geniuses, you know, who are very smart very intellectually sound, and at the same time, we can model that. We can model their personal devotion to God. I mean, they had a really unique balance. It wasn't like they were just book smart. They also had a really strong personal relationship with God, and very discerning and wise. So I think it's a good model, I think, for me and for us to look at that. So they were smart and also personal with God.
That is a good observation. And one thing that I know for me, and all of us modern day, just to put us to shame how little we know the Word of God compared to these people. So we just presume upon God's grace and the availability of the Bible in our language. But I mean, these guys, they just immersed themselves in it, and they were such masters of the Scriptures. It's just so impressive. What a great model for us.
The other thing that really stood out to me was the tension that everyone lived in. They were very much aware of the effects that their decisions would have on the church and how much gravity everything they did would ultimately play out. And again, you know, relating that to today, I don't know that we really take time to consider the gravitas between all the things that we do in the church today. And, you know, Luther very much knew the effects of what was happening, and it tore him apart, and he lived in the constant tension of, you know, what I'm doing right now going to do in terms of affecting the overall church.
Last chance. Well, thank you for those comments. Very good. I'd like to give us a chance to kind of talk about some of it. Having thought about these things over many years, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that I'm conflicted. The Reformation both is very exciting and energizing, and it's depressing at the same time. But so is life. Well, great. Let's look at now at the Reformation among the Catholics and see what they're trying to think about doing in the midst of all this.
So now we're going to look on the other side of the story and see how this even for those of you that have studied the Protestant Reformation, my guess is you probably have not spent as much time thinking about this part of the story. This chapter tends to be neglected more. Obviously, since we're Protestants, we may think we're not as interested, but it's a very important part of the story, because what will happen is a part of this Catholic reform, or what's sometimes called the Counter-Reformation. Okay, the Counter-Reformation. And that term often is used to describe the period from about the middle of the 16th century. If you know, for a ballpark figure, let's talk about 1550, all the way up to the end of the 30 Years' War, 1638. So you're talking about, you know, roughly 90 years in there as a part of the Counter-Reformation in the different movements and actions by the authorities. The Council of Trent. In fact, that's what that image is of the Council of Trent. And it will forever define what Roman Catholicism is as we know it today. Now, we're not in this class talk about Vatican I and Vatican II. We'll get to that in the Church and the World. But so much of how things developed during this era, though, would set some parameters for Catholicism ever since. So let's look at this and see how we can understand this. And one thing that I'm encouraged about this, even though things did not turn out as they wanted, is one thing that becomes very evident if you look at the Catholic side of things. There were many Catholics who are deeply saddened by this whole thing and had a real desire to mend the breach, and they couldn't do it, and they were distressed about it. And the final outcome I think of the Catholic Reform as not good from a Protestant point of view, but there were many, many people that on the Catholic side who had some of the same concerns that the Protestants did, someone like Erasmus, but just felt like they could not bring themselves to break the unity of the church. And we still live with that same tension today. As we all know, there are many, many evangelicals who are in more separatist denominations, have broken away from the mainline Protestant churches, and there are many evangelicals still in mainline churches. They may be incredibly liberal, but they just have such a passion for the unity of the church that they've not been able to separate. And whether it be in the Anglican Communion today or within Presbyterian circles, Methodist Church, Lutheran, it's the same. Same kind of tension. So this kind of scenario is always with us. All right, when we talk about the Counter-Reformation period, there's a general dates, you know, 1550, 1555 to 1648, kind of that 100-year period, more or less. Some of the things we're going to look at in this unit are the revival of the Roman Catholic Church in Europe. Where were there pockets of renewal? Some positive things that happened. We'll also try to acknowledge the fact that while they were stimulated by Protestant opposition, they were spurred to act, yet Roman Catholic Reform movements were already at work in the 16th century. As I have said repeatedly, no one on the Roman Catholic side deluded themselves that there's just no problem in the church. They knew that wasn't the case. Long before Luther said anything, there was widespread discontent and acknowledgement that something is errant and it's got to be dealt with. The influence of humanism, we'll look at that. And just as we have described its critical significance for the Protestant era, the same kind of thing on the Catholic side. The humanists would be some of the most important spokespersons for calling the church to revival and reform. Some of the new religious orders of the 16th century, I'll just mention a few of those just to give you an idea. Those some of these continue to be active in Catholicism today. But one of the things that has happened in the church down through the centuries is whenever there are times of difficulty and the church is in a slump, if you would, there are usually the voices of those calling for renewal. And one of the ways that the church through the Middle Ages has always done that in these reformers is organize themselves in new monastic communities. This is where we can bring reform to the church. We need to garner ourselves together, devote ourselves to pursuing the will of Christ, studying the Bible, and go out and spread this message. And maybe in this way we can bring a new day to the church. Well, the same thing happened in the 16th century. There are going to be new Catholic orders that will be established that are going to try to resolve things through that venue. The Inquisition. All right, we'll look at that. This is not a very favorable thing for us as modern people to think about, but it was a part of the sequence of events in this time. And then the infamous Council of Trent. And we'll talk about the three basic times when the Council of Trent met, the three parts, and what emerged theologically and practically out of the Council of Trent. So these are some of the things we're going to look at. All right, let's talk about humanism. Let's start at that point. There are many Roman Catholic scholars. Now remember, all the reformers, you know, these humanist scholars had studied at the universities, whether it was Luther in Germany or Calvin going to the University of Paris or Zwingli studying at the German universities. The number of students that studied at Oxford and Cambridge, all of these had pursued humanistic studies, had availed themselves of the new modern knowledge that had become available, especially looking at ancient Christianity again in the Greco-Roman period. And as the church is going to come unglued now, there are humanists who are going to call for reform and believe that there's a clarion call for us to remain loyal to the church as sick as she is. And one of the things that the humanists highlighted was a return to the ancient traditions. So in many ways, the Catholic humanists were voicing the same things that Luther and Calvin were in terms of, let's go back to the ancient church. Remember, Calvin's take on things were, the fathers have wonderful things to say to us. They're grand and glorious, but the medieval men heaped a bunch of junk on them. And they have taken these blessed testimonies that have come down to us and they have perverted them. And similarly, these were Roman Catholic humanists are pointing attention back to the ancient church, and that this may be the way out for us. And the humanists tended to be more tolerant toward Protestants, had dialogue with them, entered into colloquia where they would talk about the issues more openly. And many of them had gone to school together. But usually very committed, though, to the unity of the church. This is paramount, and we must safeguard the unity. And in that way, they held a very Augustinian view of the church. The church is one, and there's no salvation outside the church. And remember I'd said, Calvin said about that comment, I will accept that statement of Augustine if you show me the true church. All right, some of the key individuals, if you look down the bottom right-hand side of the screen, Erasmus, we've talked a lot about him and his debates with Luther, very prominent scholar, spends a lot of time in England. Contarini, Gasparo Contarini, we have not mentioned him yet, but he is going to be a big player, a cardinal, actually, who's going to be called upon to be involved in a lot of the discussions. He actually was at the Diet of Worms when Luther is giving his response to what about these writings of yours, Luther? You may remember back in the little film clip, Luther at Worms. Contarini is there. He will produce some writings in opposition to Luther, but he is going to be the one that will write some of the preliminary documents leading up to Trent, calling for radical reform of the church. And it's Contarini who's going to enter into discussion with Melanchthon and some of the Protestants about the whole doctrine of justification by faith. Can't we come to some agreement on this? So Contarini is a good illustration of a very high Catholic official. He's a cardinal. He participated in Roman Catholic Protestant dialogue. He ends up playing a part in Trent and had witnessed a lot of this early movement. Even Luther himself, from the very beginning, had known him and dealt with that. Well, Contarini, Jacob Sadolet, another cardinal. This is the cardinal who had written this letter to the city council in Geneva. I mentioned that Calvin responds to Calvin's famous letter to Sadolet. And here you have another humanist church official who interacted with the reformers. Juan Valdez had been a part of the reformist ideas in the humanist circle in Italy and in Spain and in Italy. Part of what a group known as the Blessed Fellowship, some of these humanists. And Peter Martyr Vermigli, the Italian reformer, had been a part of that community also. And then George Witzel. And I want to talk about a little document that he produced to give you an example of what the thinking was among some of these humanists. In his little work here, A Means of Ecclesiastical Harmony. Now notice the date. So things are really humming by 1539. The Lutheran movement has taken off. Zwingli's done his thing. Calvin's been in Geneva 3 years. And this Catholic humanist now is going to lay out his proposal, his plan for reform. No, he's not at all open to the idea of separation. But he does have some real concerns. And here's a part of his program of reform, which could be considered typical of some of these Catholic humanists. Number one, return to the simplicity and flexibility of the ancient church. The reason that this was so important, especially for the humanists who desired to see if they could commend the differences, is that what is it that Protestants and Roman Catholics historically held in common? The ancient church. You know, we can agree about that. We all like Augustine. We all like Tertullian. We like Origen. We like Justin Martyr. We like Athanasius. We like St. Cyril. We like St. Jerome. We like Basil. We like Gregory. I mean, the list could go on and on and on. They could agree. These were great men of faith. We love their writings. Now, they had some differences on interpreting certain portions of them, but a lot of it, the fathers just said what they meant and meant what they said. And so, this was something that they definitely drew attention to. Ancient church is a model for us. The Bible should be in the common language. Erasmus and all of them would concur with that. You know, this is just a shame just to have the Latin Vulgate. The people need to have the Bible. How are we going to ever bring reform if the people can't read the Holy Book? And preaching has got to take place on biblical texts. The church was devoid of preaching, and these Catholic humanists knew it. And this is where they recognized that the Protestants had really hit on an important theme, that the Word of God has got to be communicated to the people. Private masses should be abandoned. And they understood, even though they still held, most of them, to a traditional understanding of the Eucharist. This thing about private masses has just totally perverted what the Lord's Supper has been about. This is a corporate meal. Many of them advocated, you know, the people ought to get the bread and the cup. And they acknowledged the fact, even though they held to historic Catholic theology on those issues, that the whole notion of the Mass needs to be changed. This is just crazy. Education for lay church leaders. There was a dearth of knowledge, even about the Catholic faith. So education became very important. And, well, as I mentioned here, I actually talked about that bullet up here. The common roots of the Roman Catholic and Protestants in the ancient church should be emphasized. So the simplicity part of it, as far as Witzel was concerned, and Erasmus picks up on this theme, he felt like that, and Witzel talks about this as well, all of the attempt to integrate philosophy and theology in the universities, this has gotten us sidetracked from the simplicity of the gospel and the simplicity of what it means to be a Christian. And this is what made the part of what made the ancient church attractive to them long before the late medieval men had tried to integrate Aristotelian philosophy into the theological articulations of the church. All right, so the program of reform there, and one idea of kind of what they were after. And, you know, you look at that, Protestants say, we agree with that. It felt like it didn't go far enough, but that the humanists, they concurred on some of the problems. All right, the movement of religious orders through the 16th century. Let me just mention some of these. You may or may not be familiar with some of these. There are all different kinds of groups that you notice in the history of Christianity down through the years. I've got up on the two icons up in the top right-hand corner are Antony of Egypt, who we talked about in Church History 1. He is considered kind of the father or godfather of monasticism, if you would, in terms of the popularity of his story and what happened there in Egypt. And then, of course, St. Francis, who forever identified with the mendicant orders, or the begging orders, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. Benedictine monasticism from the 6th century forward had been pervasive. This had been the most prominent form of monasticism. In the early years, the hermits that lived individually, and then what's known as the cenobitic groups, those that lived in community. Those are terms related to early monasticism. And then when we get to the Reformation era, we're going to look at a few of the new orders, but the major one is going to be the Jesuits. As the Reformation scholar Louis Spitz has said, they entered into the world with a vengeance. And the Jesuits have gotten all kinds of interesting labels attached to them over the years, as the Pope's stormtroopers, you know, or these are the men that would take the Counter-Reformation really not only to Europe but to the New World also. But let's look at some of the new orders. And let me just mention briefly some of these. The Capuchins. That name comes from their four-pointed hoods. And this was a reform movement in the Franciscan order, which was recognized by the Pope in 1528, continuing that pattern of what happens when the certain orders become lax, moving away from their original rule or practice, and there are reformers who call it back to a more pristine practice of the faith. The Capuchins were known for their ministry among the poor in Italy. And by the end of the 16th century, there were 1,500 houses in Europe. So they had established many, many communities. Bernardino Ochino, who was their vicar general, became Protestant in 1542. And so this was one of the reforming monastic groups that would actually even produce a few Protestants. The Order of the Discalced. Who are they? That term means the sandal-less, or those without sandals. This group was started by a Spanish mystic. It's most associated with and influenced by this wonderful Catholic mystic, Teresa of Avila. Most of you probably heard of Teresa, this Spanish Carmelite nun. And essentially, they were trying to reform the Carmelite order. Who are the Carmelites? The Carmelites go back to the period of the Crusades, a monastic order of the 12th century, and these monks had actually started their community on Mount Carmel in Palestine. They considered themselves in the train of the prophets and Elijah, and so it was a monastic house, and Teresa of Avila, this Spanish mystic, became associated with this particular order. And the Order of the Discalced were attempting to go back to the more pristine practice of this original rule of faith. And we'll talk about Teresa a little bit more. I'm going to talk about 16th century mysticism down here, but I'll just mention her in association with that particular order. Another one, the Oratory of Divine Love. The Latin word oratorium means place of prayer. This was 50 clergy and laymen in Rome that were devoted to reform. And certain members of this community, which were committed to seeking reform in the church. Cardinal Sadoleto Contarini was a member. Gian Pietro Carafa, who would eventually be Pope Paul IV, who is instrumental in the Council of Trent. But another illustration, this Oratory of Divine Love, of some of these humanists committing themselves together to a life of prayer and seeking for the good of the church. The Order of the Theatines. This was an order founded by Carafa and another gentleman in southern Italy. And its call was to bring the clergy back to a life of godliness and laity to a life of virtue. They were distressed by the immorality that they saw in the church, and being Italians and close to Rome, they saw a lot of it. According to Luther and the other reformers, they founded many oratories, that is, places of prayer, hospitals, and also sent missionaries out to the Near East and also to the East Indies. And then a unique order for women, the Ursulines. Now, this was a society of virgins who had modified the rule of St. Augustine, founded by Angela Merici in 1535. And they were devoted especially to the education and nurture of young Christian girls, and had a desire to do that. This was one of the leading teaching orders for women. So these are just a handful, but this is by no means exhaustive. But some of the new movements, some small, some large, which were trying to, on the fringes of the church, do deeds of mercy and good, and are trying to bring about some reformation. Now, in terms of mysticism, I think I had mentioned to you the intriguing thesis about the role of mysticism in the life of Martin Luther, who had his first publication was a commentary on the old German mystic work known as the German Theology. And the mysticism had had deep roots in the history of the church going back to the early medieval era. And two names, especially associated, I think, with the 16th century, are both Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross. And if you want their dates for your notes, I'll give those to you just to give you a framework. Teresa of Avila, 1515 to 1582, and St. John of the Cross, who actually was one of Teresa's disciples, 1542 to 1591. Now, I know not all of you have had Church History 1, so let me just give you a context for mysticism and what we're talking about when we refer to Christian mysticism. What Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross advocated were ideas that had emerged in the medieval church related to an understanding of spirituality, which involved sometimes visions, trances, ecstasy, but a movement toward union with the divine being. Union with the divine being. And there usually were three steps, and St. John of the Cross repeats these three steps pretty straightforwardly in the mystical writings that had been around in the church for hundreds of years. Number one is purgation. This is where, through meditation and prayer, the individual seeks to rid himself or herself of the concerns for this world. The purgation of the soul, an emptying, if you would. Now, the second stage after purgation was illumination. This is where the divine light shines in. And again, you know, words were used to try to describe these experiences, but again, by the nature of mysticism, they were more experiential in terms of an encounter with the divine. And you don't find a lot of description sometimes about exactly what these things entail. But the stages of purgation, then illumination, then finally union. Union with Christ, where the human soul and the person of God are united. And a term that was used sometimes among the mystics was the beatific vision. The vision beautiful, where you have eventually are so purged yourself of this world, and your life is so filled with the divine light that you're able to enter into union with the divine. Now, Teresa of Avila, in her writings, talked about the spiritual marriage. And this had been a common theme. This is the way Bernard of Clairvaux had talked about this union with Christ in terms of his interpretation of the Song of Solomon. But several of Teresa's works that would be still are highly revered by Catholics today, the Way of Perfection and also the Interior Castle. The Way of Perfection and the Interior Castle. And there you can still find her writings today. There's paperback series called The Classics of Western Spirituality. I don't know if any of you have ever seen those. They have a lot of these pietistic and mystical writings. In fact, Luther's edition of the German Theology is one of those volumes. But you could get Teresa of Avila's works there and her emphasis on prayer. What made her so, I think, engaging and still does for Catholics is, I don't know about you, but when you think of mysticism, sometimes you think of a heightened pietism that is all about separation from the world. But she was very much of an activist in terms of mercy ministry and caring for people. And so she has kind of been held up as a model because of her intense mysticism and her sincere activism, both in her life, which was considered kind of a model. Now, John of the Cross, who again was a disciple of Teresa's, St. John of the Cross, and a couple of his works I'll just mention if you want them for your notes, the Spiritual Canticle, and also the Living Flame of Love. And that's where he would talk about this union with God. Any of you remember that medieval work known as the Cloud of Unknowing? Maybe you've heard of that. That's kind of a classic of medieval mysticism, and many point out the parallels between the Cloud of Unknowing and the work of St. John of the Cross, especially in his Living Flame of Love, although odds are he probably never even read it. But there's an uncanny parallel there. But it's not too surprising in terms of their common roots, though, and these themes in the mystic writings seem to carry over from the generations of purgation, illumination, and then union. Well, those were important, and as you might guess, both Teresa and John are eventually canonized by the Catholic Church, so they're officially saints. Aren't you impressed? But, you know, it's easy for us, it's break time, it's easy. Let me just make this comment. I mentioned those two people because you ought to know who they are. I mean, St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila are very influential, continue to be held up as models of Roman Catholic piety. Let's don't go to the extreme that just because these people are Catholic and didn't embrace, you know, all the Protestant ideas, that they have nothing worthwhile to say about life in Christ. It's important to have a balance in these things. And so, you know, if you have a chance to read some of the Catholic spiritual writers, by all means, if you're interested, do so. I think there can be some things that you can learn there. You don't agree with all of it, but I hope when you read the Reformers, you don't agree with everything you read either, because they're fallible men. Hopefully you probably agree with a whole lot more of it than you would some of these writers, but it doesn't mean they don't have something worthwhile to say.
So, just leave you with that thought. Yes?
Dr. Fortson, a really good book was Spiritual Theology by Diogenes Allen. Mm-hmm. He's a real sound guy who takes into account a lot of those writings and sees some benefit from some of those practices. So.
That's great. Thank you for mentioning that. That is an outstanding book. It's called Spiritual
Theology by Diogenes Allen. Let me write his first name up here. He is a professor at Princeton Seminary. He's really close to retirement now. But he has an interesting story. I'll just end with his story. He is like Thomas Oden. We actually had Diogenes Allen give a lecture here some years ago when he was actually in town speaking at an Episcopalian church. We heard he was in town and said, please come over and speak to the students. So he talked in chapel. And he talked a little bit about his book, Spiritual Theology. But here he was, a prominent, liberal Protestant theologian, but he just found his life real empty. And he started reading the early church fathers, particularly some of those called the spiritual writers, the desert fathers, and some of those, and it just opened his eyes to Christianity in some fresh ways to understand the faith. In his book, Spiritual Theology, he picks up on that and emphasizes what became known among the desert fathers as the eight deadly thoughts. Now, later on, you know those as the seven deadly sins, you know, of later Catholicism, but the eight deadly thoughts. And in this book, he talks about how practical those things are from the monastic heritage for just basic Christian living. So I recommend that book. It's called Spiritual Theology by Diogenes Allen.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.